We're now on Radio 4. It's time to join JCT Jennings and his friends at Linbury Court School as Mark Williams reads the final part of Jennings's Little Hut by Anthony Buckeridge.
While Roger Merridew bounded towards the woods with Jennings and Derbyshire in frantic pursuit, his mother and grandfather were seated in the headmaster's study. General Merridew rose to his feet.
"There's a breathless hush if you are somewhere," he declaimed, waving his teacup in the air.
"I beg your pardon?" queried the headmaster, out of his depth. "I think my father-in-law means it's very quiet in here," interrupted Mrs. Merridew.
"No, no," said the general. "I was trying to remember that poem. You know the one. There's a breathless hush in the close tonight. Ten to make, and the match to win. A bumping pitch and a something or other. Play up, and play the game."
Mrs. Merridew knew that the general would be prepared to recite ill-remembered verses of poetry until dark, unless something was done about it. So she rose and said, "Thank you so much for showing us round, Mr. Pemberton Oakes."
"Not at all," smiled the headmaster. "If you could let me know fairly soon whether Roger is to come here in the autumn."
"I can tell you that now," she answered.
"Splendid! You'd like me to enter him for next term?"
"No, I'm afraid not." General Merridew nearly dropped his teacup.
"Eh? What's that, Diana?" he barked. "Dash it all, if Linbury Court was good enough for me, ought to be good enough for a young scamp like Roger."
"It's not that," Mrs. Merridew replied quietly. "If anything, it's the other way about. Roger isn't good enough for Linbury, if goodness means changing him into a highly polished little boy with smartly knotted bootlaces. I admit everything here is organised most efficiently, but from what I've seen, the boys aren't given much chance to be themselves." Too late. The headmaster realised that he had stressed the wrong things and showed his guests a school which was too good to be true. The best suits, the close haircuts, the unbelievable tidiness of everything had been a mistake. Mr. Carter had been right. It would have been better if the school had been wearing its normal, lived-in appearance. "If you don't mind," said Mrs. Merridew, "I think we'll go and find Roger and get back to town." Roger was fast approaching the Derbyshire pontoon suspension bridge.
"Come here!" Jennings called as loudly as he dared. "We're not allowed over there!"
His plea fell upon deaf ears.
"Darby, you are a bazooka," telling him about the huts and calmly pointing out where they were. "How was I to know he'd do a bunk?" said Derbyshire. "Anyway, it should be all right. The Archbishop won't be bringing the General and Mrs. Merridew over here. At least I shouldn't think so."
All the same, Jennings was worried. Mr. Carter had given him 24 hours in which to prove himself a reliable member of the community. Not more than 30 minutes of his time had passed, and already he was breaking bounds and had lost a new boy entrusted to his care. The wood was ideal country for a fugitive, and Roger had the time of his life. He crept from hut to hut, taking cover behind thick clumps of bulrushes, always on the move, always ready to double back on his tracks if his pursuers should draw near. There had been few playmates in Roger Merridew's life, and he was determined to make the most of a first-class game of hide-and-seek while he had the chance. There was no malice in his heart, no spite in his thoughts. It never entered his head that this exciting game could result in endless trouble for his guides. Through a spy-hole in Atkinson's hut, Jennings caught a glimpse of a green pullover and grey corduroy shorts making for the water's edge. He waited until the figure came nearer.
"Come on, Darby, quick!" he shouted,
then dashed out of the hut and raced away in pursuit. With a squeal of joy, Roger took to his heels and dashed helter-skelter through a soggy swamp on the bank of the pond, splashing mud freely in all directions. Jennings was gaining on him, and Roger leapt at the first spot of cover he could see. It was the entrance to Bromwich's basement elephant trap, and he slithered blindly down the slope and rolled over and over on the earthy floor at the bottom. The chase was over. Kindly, but firmly, Jennings helped the captive to his feet and escorted him up to ground level as Derbyshire came dashing up to join the fray. "Have you got him? Oh, Wizzo!" he shouted, and then stopped and stared at the small boy in wide-eyed dismay. "Oh, golly! Just look at him!" Roger Merridew was not a pretty sight. There was a great tear in his trousers. He was mud-splashed from head to foot, and thin red scratches ran down his arms and appeared again above the socks drooping about his ankles. Derbyshire looked away. The sight was too much for him. "Jolly decent game, isn't it?" Roger squealed happily. "I was pretending I was an aeroplane."
"Oh, golly, whatever are we going to do?" Derbyshire wailed. "I've never seen anyone in such a mess.
Except you, of course, Jed. Well, let's get away from here for a start." In gloomy silence, they made for the pontoon suspension bridge. Only Roger was unconcerned.
"It's all right," he told them. "I've got lots more pairs of trousers at home."
"I don't care if you've got 50 million pairs of trousers at home. What I want to know is, whatever is the head going to say when he sees you looking like a second-hand scarecrow?"
Derbyshire touched his friend lightly on the arm.
"You'll soon know, Jen."
Jennings glanced across the bridge. Three people were approaching from the direction of the cricket field. They were, reading from left to right, Lieutenant General Sir Melville Merridew, Mrs. Diana Merridew, and M.W.B. Pemberton Oaks, Esquire.
The following morning, at 9:05, Jennings and Derbyshire set off for the headmaster's study. They were accompanied part of the way by a small crowd of well-wishers and sympathisers, who trooped behind like a funeral procession, uttering words of doubtful comfort.
"Think they're going to swishing?" asked Atkinson.
"Oh, they're bound to," said Bromwich Major. "What a pity it's the summer term. If it was winter, they'd be wearing thicker underpants."
The procession halted at a safe distance from the study, and Jennings and Derbyshire walked on alone. When they reached the door, Jennings said, "Go on, Derby. Bags you knock."
"No, bags you. I'm not much cop at knocking on doors. I might make a bish of it."
"All right, then. Let's get it over."
Jennings tapped the panel softly, and then held his breath until the summons to enter came from within. The headmaster's face was devoid of expression as he looked up from his desk. He stared at them in silence for some moments. Then he said,
"I have given some thought to your extraordinary behaviour yesterday afternoon, and frankly, I am at a loss to understand it. It wasn't really our fault, sir. You see, that'll do, Jennings. Actions speak louder than words, and no amount of explanation will convince me that what I saw yesterday with my own eyes..."
At that moment, the telephone rang, and the headmaster lifted the receiver.
"Hello? Linbury Court School?"
"Yes, it's the headmaster speaking."
"Who is that?"
"Oh.
Hold on a moment, will you, please?"
He nodded an order to Jennings and Derbyshire to wait outside in the corridor, and as the door closed behind them, he said,
"Good morning, Mrs. Merridew."
"Good morning, Mr. Pemberton Oaks. I'm ringing because I've been thinking things over," said Mrs. Merridew, "particularly about that little scene by the pond."
"Mrs. Merridew," said the headmaster, "once again, I can only apologise..."
"No, no," interrupted Mrs. Merridew. "Roger has been telling me that the boys built the most wonderful huts there and have feasts in them. It sounds splendid fun, and Roger can hardly wait to come to school and start building one himself. So, I would like to change my mind and send Roger to Linbury next term, if it's convenient for you to have him." The headmaster's brow puckered in a frown of indecision. To explain that the huts were now a thing of the past, and the pond was out of bounds, would mean that the youngest Merridew would not be sent to follow in the footsteps of his distinguished grandfather.
"I think you can rest assured, Mrs. Merridew," the headmaster replied, "that Roger will be given ample scope to indulge in suitable forms of outdoor recreation."
"That's fine, then. Oh, yes, and those two boys who organised that wonderful game of hide-and-seek for him, you won't be annoyed with them, will you? Roger says it wasn't their fault that his clothes got in that state." Again, the headmaster pondered. Then he said, "Quite frankly, Mrs. Merridew, I had intended to punish them severely. Punish them? Oh, but surely they deserve a reward, more than a punishment. After all, I should never have decided to send Roger to Lynbury if they hadn't shown me the more human side of school life." A little while later, Jennings and Derbyshire ranged themselves before the headmaster's desk once more.
"Well," said the headmaster, "and what have you two got to say for yourselves?"
Jennings said, "Please, sir, we're very sorry we made such a mess of Roger, sir."
"Ah, well, it was just an accident, I suppose," replied the headmaster. "And you'll be pleased to hear that Roger will be coming to school here next term."
He paused, as though in doubt about what to say next.
I have been thinking over the whole question of these huts, and I have come to the conclusion that there is, after all, something to be said in their favour. Properly organised, they could provide excellent opportunities to develop a knowledge of woodcraft, nature study, bird-watching, and, perhaps an occasional picnic might not come amiss, eh?"
"Yes, sir, of course, sir. But I thought—" Jennings stopped, unable to make head or tail of this sudden change of opinion.
"I propose, therefore, to remove the ban which I imposed last Monday," the headmaster continued. "Let me see. There's no cricket match this afternoon, so it might be a good idea for you two boys to go over there during net practice and repair the damage to your hut which, took place on the occasion of my visit."
"Thank you, sir. Thank you very much indeed, sir." Jennings' little hut was not so seriously damaged as he and Derbyshire had at first supposed. Most of the remnants were lying close at hand, and it wasn't difficult to make a workmanlike job of putting them together again. Hearing the sound of excited voices, they made their way to the hut door. Stampeding through the wood towards them came 77 boys, clutching paper bags and plastic beakers, while the staff followed behind at a more dignified pace. Bringing up the rear was Bromwich Major. He was having to walk even slower than the staff, the reason being that he was carrying a tank of water in which a small goldfish seemed to be practising the breaststroke backwards. When the last sandwich had been eaten, the last beaker of lemonade had been drained, the hut builders returned to their pond-side occupations at the point where they had left off nearly a week before. Jennings squatted on his heels in the low doorway of the little hut, listening to the busy sounds of the neighbouring hut owners. It was growing late, and soon the whistle would blow, and the squatters would be streaming back to school and up to the dormitory, and tomorrow a new day would start, bringing new problems to face and new crises to cope with. But why worry about tomorrow? It was today that mattered, and nothing could spoil that now. Jennings glowed with quiet happiness, and suddenly, for no reason that he could think of, he laughed aloud.
"What's the matter?" asked Derbyshire.
"Oh, nothing. I just felt like it."
"You know, Derby, when things are going well like this, I can almost believe those old geezers who come down on speech day and tell us that being at school is the happiest time of your life."
Mark Williams was reading the final part of Jennings's Little Hut by Anthony Buckeridge, abridged by Roy Apps. It was a peer production for BBC Radio 4.